Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with guest co-host Andy Lee Roth. Peter Phillips will be back next week. Today's Friday, November 2nd. Today on the program, we take a close look at Censored 2013, dispatches from the media revolution just released this week on Seven Stories Press. Over the hour, we will be in conversation with several of the contributors to our newest annual volume of underreported news stories with added media analysis. We're going to hear about some of the top 25 censored stories the corporate media won't tell you about. We'll look at some case studies of media propaganda and news abuse, and we'll have some good news stories and signs of hope that people don't get to hear much about either when Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine helps us round out the show today. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, joined in studio today with guest co-host Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Today's program is our annual program that we do on the release of the Project Censored book, which this year is Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution. That was compiled and edited by myself with my co-host, Andy Lee Roth, and also has contributions from hundreds of students, scores of faculty. You know, we're looking at over almost two dozen campuses across the U.S. and across the world. And what we look at every year are the top stories that are unreported, underreported, or otherwise distorted by the corporate news media. And the KPFA and Pacifica audience, of course, are oft aware of many of the types of stories that are published by Project Censored and our publishers at Seven Stories Press in New York, because the mission of Pacifica and the mission of Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation are very similar. So this morning, we're going to be hearing from a large number, actually, six or seven different folks that were contributors to this year's volume. And the topics, of course, the main topic is media censorship, underreporting, media propaganda. But each of the folks that are joining us this morning talk about it in a very specific way. Our first guest would be Elliot Cohen, who's going to talk about the police state and so forth. Susan Rahman talking about gender bias, ethnicity bias in media coverage. We're joined also by Adam Bessie talking about privatization of education. Later in the program, we'll hear from Almirinda Ojeda, who talks about Guantanamo speak and propaganda of language control and framing. We'll get to hear from Tara Drabji, a common voice that KPFA listeners may recall about her work on censorship in Kashmir. And we'll finish up today with Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine. But before we get into these series of dialogues we're going to have with our wonderful contributors, I'd like to have Andy Lee Roth talk a little bit about the frame of this year's book in particular. We had the pleasure of working with Banned Books Week this year, and folks of National Coalition Against Censorship, the American Library Association, many others, Chris Finan, Barbara Jones. We even have a little segment on Banned Books Week in here this year in 2013. And we dedicated the book to Ray Bradbury, champion of the freedom to think, feel, and express, and of the responsibility to remember. So, Andy, could you set up some of the what we were after this year?
Well, one of the ways we frame the introduction to the book is with a scene, a crucial scene from Bradbury's classic and celebrated Fahrenheit 451. And in this scene, the protagonist, fireman Guy Montag, reaches a turning point after realizing that his actions earlier that day at work contradict his inner convictions. And he's in their living room. He's in his living room with his wife. They're bombarded by entertainment on multiple screens. And Montag confesses his growing sense of unease to his spouse. She refuses to consider his concerns. "Let me alone," she says. "I didn't do anything." Montag responds, "We need not to be let alone. We need to be really bothered once in a while." "How long," he asks her, "is it since you were really bothered about something important, about something real?" And for anyone paying attention, 2011-2012 has provided a number of news stories about which we ought to be truly bothered. And in Censored 2013, we engage in the dual tasks of holding to account the corporate media, who often, it seems, would rather be let alone than bothered when it comes to real important news. And we also celebrate the work of independent journalists and the independent outlets that present their work to a wider audience for their role in keeping us bothered when we should be, for not letting us become complacent and accepting of a status quo that's unjust, unfair, and unsustainable. So that's really a broad frame for the contents of Censored 2013. We're real proud of the book and excited to have it out, of course.
Yeah, the top stories that we looked at this year, we've been looking at Censored News clusters as themes each year for the last couple years. So we actually have themes running in the stories for connecting the dots, things that journalists often are supposed to do, but don't always. So we have actually news clusters here on the police state and civil liberties. We have a segment on bankster bailouts and the U.S. economy for the 99%. We have an environment and health section, human costs of war and violence, and women, gender, race, and ethnicity, all of our top censored news clusters in the beginning of the book here. Our first guest is Dr. Elliot Cohen, who writes in the book for us about all of the stories that dealt with the police state and civil liberties. In fact, the number one censored story this year is a collection of stories that talk about the signs of an emerging police state. And who better to talk about that is our longtime contributor, Dr. Elliot Cohen. He's a contributor to Truth Out, Truth Dig, editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Applied Philosophy, ethics editor for Free Inquiry Magazine, blogger for Psychology Today, author of several books, including Mass Surveillance and State Control, the Total Information Awareness Project. Elliot Cohen joins us this morning by phone. Elliot, are you with us?
I'm here.
Thanks so much, Elliot, for joining us. Could you talk a little bit about the we want to do two things with you. We want to talk briefly about the analysis you did about the signs of the emerging police state, of course, which includes NDAA. It includes FBI being responsible for terrorist plots in the United States, prison slavery. But, of course, you also have another contribution, the information war, how the government is seeking total information awareness and what this portends for freedom and democracy. So let's begin with some of your analysis of the stories, Elliot.
Okay, well, the one article that I did was what I called the information war, and that sort of encompasses a number of the kinds of issues that arise with respect to the police state. But the main theme there is that there's really a government interest in knowledge, to acquire knowledge, to control knowledge, to make sure that everything that people know is okay to know from their perspective. And we used to burn books, but not anymore. Now it's mainly restricted to the internet. And that's a main theme, too, with this, what I'm calling the information war, that the government wants to control the internet. They want to control what we hear, what we know, what we see, and they're basically legalizing the ability to do it. And I can speak a bit about some of that, if that's okay.
Yes, that'd be great, Elliot. And you talk, of course, in the book about the Stop Online Piracy Act, and you talk also about executive orders and so on. So please go ahead and share that.
Well, one of the things that's really troubling, and it started back in 2005, was the idea that the internet should be under the control of corporations. It shouldn't be a public utility as it was considered up until 2005 with the Supreme Court decision of Brand X. Essentially, what that did was turn the internet into a private roadway, so to speak, a private utility that's controlled by these giant corporations like Comcast and AT&T and so forth. And this opened up the door to controlling information. And there's been a steady progression there. And FCC, Comcast versus FCC in 2010, gave these corporations the right to control information that comes down these internet pipes. And they can control and they can slow and the information. Now what's problematic here is that there's a connection between these corporations and the government, because the government now has the authority to put stuff inside, put various kinds of equipment to monitor internet activity inside the giant telecom corporations. And so what we're having now is the government having, you know, access to all the information, you know, that flows through these pipes. Plus, I mean, you have the situation where now these corporations have the power to control this information, and they're under the thumb of the government. So essentially what you have is the edifice, you know, the infrastructure for control, manipulation, and essentially preventing people from, you know, exercising their civil liberties. I mean, that's the infrastructure that we have right now.
Elliot, Andy Roth here. Part of that infrastructure of control also involves what you describe in your chapter as the legalization of domestic propaganda. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012.
Yeah, well, essentially, the government can disseminate information over the internet or through the media, through publishers, and they can send it overseas. They can have it bounce back into the states, and this is just no realization that it's just government propaganda, and it gets filtered into infiltrates the system, and people believe it. And this is another way of information control, because if people hear information from the government, they're not hearing it from a reliable media source, and the mass media is not, at least the corporate media is not available to decipher what's true and what's false, because as I said, they're working for the government. So I mean, we're, you know, it's part of the whole scene.
And of course, Elliot, you also talk in your chapter about popular resistance to this kind of information warfare, and you give readers, and now we'd like to also give listeners some tools to fight back against these measures.
Yeah, I think that what's necessary now are, you know, more development of programs like Project Censored, where citizens become the journalists, and they keep an eye on the media. We need a watchdog of the watchdog, because the watchdog's, you know, sleeping on the job. And it's worse than that. It's being controlled by government. And so what we need is, I believe a fifth estate behind the fourth estate, some form of league of citizen journalists who basically train and learn how to do their job as journalists and speak truth to power. And I think it, without anything less than citizen activity to pull in the reins on this structure of power and control. Ultimately, we're going to lose the ability to know very much of anything. And in this whole process, you know, technology keeps getting better and better, and better at controlling, and better at invading privacy. And as this keeps growing, the need is going to grow more and more for some kind of process to move in the opposite direction, to prevent this from exploding any further than it already has.
And Dr. Elliot Cohen, you also analyzed the top stories in the first part of Censored 2013, The Signs of an Emerging Police State, and NDAA is one of the big stories that we were dealing with. We only have about 30 seconds left, which isn't enough to get into that, but there are movements afoot to stop the NDAA and to try to call that out as well. And we'll have to have you back on sometime in the near future to hear more about what you're doing. And we also know that you teach critical thinking and you're with students all the time. And again, that's the first line of defense against many of the problems that we face that you've just outlined.
That's right.
Thanks so much, Elliot, for joining us. We'll certainly be talking with you again.
My pleasure.
Our next guest, Andy Roth, is Susan Rahman.
Susan Rahman's an instructor of sociology at Diablo Valley College. I'm sorry, not Diablo Valley College, Santa Rosa Junior College. My colleague Mickey Huff is at Diablo Valley College. Susan Rahman is at Santa Rosa Junior College and also the College of Marin, where she teaches classes that help her students to identify power, privilege, and inequalities with the goal of positive social transformation. Susan, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you.
So good to have you on with us this morning. I want to start by asking you about basically your connection to the project. Why have you chosen to integrate Project Censored into the curriculum of your classes?
Well, I think it's a perfect fit. I started sort of following it when I became faculty at Santa Rosa JC, and I had Peter Phillips come in and talk about alternative media and just media bias in general, and he invited me to start doing it with my students, and we really love it. And so it's very hands-on, it's very empowering for the students because they get to hunt down things that they think are important. I know you guys are teachers too, so you know that some assignments are really, really exciting for students and some are sort of ho-hum, and I think this one is really fantastic in the sense that they get to have choice, you know. They get to look for the media, a story that's grasped their interest, and they get to see it through from beginning to end. I was just looking at the site this morning and reading some of them, and it's just a really great project.
So Susan Rahman's students contributed 4 of the top 25 stories in Censored 2013. Susan, could you describe for us a little bit of the research process that students are utilizing to find these stories and to bring them forward so successfully?
Yeah, I think actually one of the things to know about Project Censored is it really does prepare them for learning how to do library research in an effective manner, because the first thing they get to do is just learn about the concept of corporate media in the first place and understand, you know, either media is sponsored by, you know, funded by corporations or not. Like, for example, KPFA is not. And they get to kind of learn about that. And then we teach them about alternative media sites, and they go hunt down a story that they're really interested in, and then they do like a library search where they try to look at keywords and try to find out if there's other coverage of the story, and they get into this little battle where they try to kill each other's stories, and it's really fun. And then once they feel like their story is pretty unique and not being covered in mainstream or corporate media, they get to come forward with it. They write a summary about it, and then they present it to me, and then myself and a student who's been doing the project for a long time, Liliana, we read them, and we make sure they're okay. And once we feel like they're, you know, suitable, we send them to you guys, and then a lot of them make it up on the site, and it's pretty neat because they get to see their name in, you know, kind of lights.
So those stories are posted on the Project Censored website as validated independent news stories.
Yes.
And from there they go on, and we have voting by all the participating affiliate campuses, and ultimately judging by an international panel of experts on media and media analysis. And that's how the books, how the top 25 in the book is constituted each year. You mentioned your student Liliana Valdez Madera, Susan, and she, the two of you co-authored the Censored News Cluster on Women and Gender, Race and Ethnicity, where you write that the corporate media have failed to adequately represent women and people of color. Could you give us an example, perhaps, of that in terms of contemporary coverage?
Sure. I mean, media, you know, mainstream media or corporate media does a lot of, you know, kind of stereotypical biasing of people of color and women. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that there's so many diverse representations of all people of all shapes and sizes and colors, and we seem to be pigeonholed into certain little categories that are not always flattering. And so, you know, to be able to bring forth stories that show people of color and women in strong roles, I think, is very empowering, not only for us as teachers and students, but for the culture in general.
Susan Rahman.
Yes, sir.
This is Mickey Huff. Thanks again so much for joining us, and thanks again for your contributions here in Censored 2013. Among the stories that you covered, they all, of course, stand out. But in the brief time that we have left here, there's one on Palestinian women prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Shackled during childbirth, and interest. If you could talk a little bit about that, just briefly, and it's important that that's in the book. But I also just wanted to say that it was interesting that a student, when they saw that story, had asked me. They said, Well, why was that the case that you covered this story about Palestine? Because there are also women that are shackled in prisons here in the United States and undergoing some of these kinds of actions, the recipients of this type of state repression. And actually, the answer that I had was, well, we research what we can, we do what we can, and we don't know everything, and not everything comes across the desk. So we need listeners, we need students, we need members of the community to be the watchdogs that Elliot Cohen was just talking about, and to help us to really better inform the public. Could you talk a little bit about that story?
Yeah, actually, that wasn't my story, but I think it's a really important story. And any woman being shackled during childbirth seems a little odd and a little unnecessary. If anybody's ever given birth, you know that you're probably not going to run away or hurt anybody during childbirth. But I think if on any level, in any country, in any place, it's a terrible thing. But as far as getting news and information out of what's going on, in Israel-Palestine, I don't think that's covered a lot in our United States media. And so I think it was a very important story. And I think we as teachers don't always see everything. I think that's a really important point. And actually, one of the things that I really like about Project Censored is that the stories that come across my desk teach me in so many different amazing ways. I get to hear stories that I wouldn't normally be finding, because, you know, one person researching all of this could spend their lifetime doing it, but it's not really likely. So to have all this student input, all this information coming in really, really increases my ability to be an effective teacher, because I'm always current and I'm getting, you know, new information. I echo your point that we don't really have a lot of control over what stories come into us, but once we get them, it's what we do with them that kind of takes it from there.
Yeah, Susan Rahman, thanks again so much for your contributions, for your teaching, and certainly for the analysis you did. And when I was referring to that story in the book, I meant that you had analyzed it as part of the cluster. Mm-hmm. It came in from others. We have stories, of course, that come in from all over the U.S. and many colleges and universities, and we try to build this base of awareness. So thanks again so much for all of your efforts.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
After this brief musical break from our friends at Beso Negro, we'll be back with Adam Bessie to talk about privatization of education and junk food news. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Andy Lee Roth. Peter Phillips will be back with us next week. This morning, we've been discussing Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution, which is just released from Seven Stories Press. It's our annual book on what the media missed and why, where we analyze media propaganda, ownership, advertising, gender bias. The first part of the show, we heard from Elliot Cohen on the information war, Susan Rahman. And right now, we're going to turn our attention twofold to some things that we do at Project Censored. One is called Junk Food Abuse, and the other is News Abuse. For years, Carl Jensen, the founder, would be questioned. The project's been around since 1976, but would be questioned by journalists and editors and so on, and say, well, some of these critiques of censorship sound a little harsh. We only have so much time and space and so forth to cover certain issues in media. And so sometimes things fall through the cracks. So Carl Jensen said, okay, that sounds like a fair assessment. So he started to really look at what the corporate news media actually did cover with their time rather than just what they don't cover. And he came up with this whole category of junk food news. And what we would look at today is the how much the corporate news media time is spent on the Paris Hiltons, the Kim Kardashians, the Tebows, and so forth. Again, junk food for the brain, so to speak, so-called reality television. This year in the book, we look at what's called American Idol, IDLE, right? We look at this kind of phenomenon in our media. But we also have a category on news abuse, and Peter Phillips took this a step further years ago to say, well, there are stories that we cover that are legitimate news stories, but the way that they're spun is they're really spun into a very distracting way that misses the mark, misses the point. And someone that's with us right now in studio that's helped us talk about news abuse the last couple years, and in fact, has an entire chapter in the book this year on privatization of education, what's called germ warfare, it's the global education reform movement, is Adam Bessie, colleague of mine at Diablo Valley College in the English department. So Adam Bessie, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And also, you've worked on a new graphic novel
yeah.
on education as well. So could you talk to us just a little bit about your work with Project Censored on news abuse and then segue into your work with education about illuminating some of the issues with so-called education reform, Adam?
Sure. The news abuse idea is we take a legitimate story and it's spun in a way that makes it illegitimate or frames the wrong part of it. And so nowhere have we seen this phenomenon, at least in my reading, more vividly is in the coverage of education. As an educator for the last decade, it's been incredibly exciting that schools are finally covered. I mean, there was just a desert where there was no coverage on schools. It's like nothing we did ever existed, right? And then suddenly, come about 2008, 2009, schools are all over the news. You hear about failing schools all the time. You have people saying education is a civil rights issue of our generation. Finally, schools are getting the attention they deserve, and we're finally, for the first time as a country, talking about how do we educate our children. Wonderful, exciting. However, the frame of the story has led us to come back to what our previous guest, Susan, said about stereotyping. You have this stereotype of teachers as destroying education, this bad teacher, this slovenly, lazy, just sitting at the front desk, the worst teacher you've ever had, right? Picking her nose or something and reading the newspaper and waiting to collect her pension. And she's in this failing school and she's protected by these evil unions. And they've conspired together to destroy not only the schools, but our entire economy. You'd think that the economy fell apart not because banksters had gambled on Wall Street, but because Miss Washington was sitting at her front desk reading the newspaper waiting out her pension. So it's a wonderful, it's great we're talking about schooling, but the frame has really created this victimizing of public servants.
And Adam Bessie, there's a backfill in terms of the language with the loaded terms that are
yes.
used, like save our schools and so forth. I mean, you know, you're not going to get people standing up saying, no, don't save our schools.
No.
So it's this propagandistic frame that leads people to follow some of these stories because
yeah.
they are interesting and even titillating. And in the popular culture, that's the news abuse element of these.
Yeah, and let me jump back on that. Go back to Ray Bradbury for a minute. He was talking about information control via burning books. Well, at this point, you don't need to burn books. You just need to frame the language in such a way that it misdirects people in a different direction. Failing schools is a perfect example. Before 2008, nobody ever heard the term failing schools. Now it's in hundreds and hundreds of news stories used uncritically as if it's common language. But think for a minute what's implied in failing schools. The school has failed. The teachers have failed. And it's their responsibility. It's not the community that's failed. It's not an economic system that has put 20% of children in poverty. It's not a social system that has no health care, so that the children are going to school without glasses. No, it's the teachers that have failed. It's the schools that have failed. So implied in that one phrase, failing schools, you have an entire worldview, an entire way of looking at the problem. And the problem here with news abuse is that reporters are using this phrase uncritically. And in doing so, they're virally spreading germ, the global education reform movement, which essentially means schools should be run like businesses. Since our schools are failing, let's give them over to the private sector where they'll no longer fail, but they'll succeed.
Right. And so, Adam, you described this then as, in effect, a corporate occupation
mm-hmm.
of the education debate. that term "occupy" is a powerfully resonant one in this time. Say more about what does this corporate occupation of education consist of?
Well, that term "failing schools" is not an accident. This is a carefully designed phrase, such as you'd get from the Frank Luntzes of the world that design language, and Bill and Melinda Gates put $80 million into public relations to put out stories that use these terms. So, for example, did you see Waiting for Superman documentary? $2 million from Bill and Melinda Gates. It makes the failing school story come to life. Did you see Won't Back Down with Viola Davis and with Maggie Gyllenhaal? Funded by billionaires, again, to promote the idea that schools are failing and that we should have businesses come in and take them over. And so quite literally, corporations are behind controlling the language used to debate it. And why I use the phrase "occupy" is that I want to say that we need to reoccupy the debate and divest ourselves, resist this language, and find a new, more organic, public way to talk about education.
Adam Bessie, again, we're running through, have a kind of a fast-paced program this morning. Mm-hmm. We're running through a lot of the contents of Censored 2013 for listeners there, and we're going to jump off to our next guest at this point, but you've been working on this issue a long time. It's great to have you back with Project Censored working on this, and this new work you have is called The Disaster Capitalism Curriculum, The High Price of Education Reform in the United States with Dan Archer. So that's something that people can also...
And you just go to Arch Comics, that's A-R-C-H, comics with an X on the end, and go to the store and you can get it there. Thank you very much, Mickey.
Well, thanks for joining us, Adam. Also, we'll be at Moe's Books tomorrow night at 7:30 in Berkeley. If folks want to follow up and hear some of our guests today, we'll announce that again later today, this morning. Our next guest is Professor Almeredo Ojeda. He's a professor of linguistics at the University of California, Davis, where he serves as founding director of the Center for Study of Human Rights in the Americas. And he's the principal investigator for its flagship Guantanamo Testimonials Project. Almeredo joined us earlier this year on a marathon program on issues of torture. He contributed a chapter which was based on a speech he gave this past year called Guantanamo Speak and the Manufacture of Consent. This is yet another theme that we have in the book. You heard Adam Bessie just talking about framing and propaganda of language. And here we now have Almeredo Ojeda talking about a similar thing, but with a different focus, a different subject. Almeredo, are you with us this morning?
I am. Hi.
Welcome to the show, Almeredo. So great. One of the themes of your Guantanamo Speak chapter is that language abuse enables prisoner abuse. Could you unpack the logic of that claim for our audience?
Absolutely. The thing is that to abuse a human being is hard work. It's not easy to do. We're somehow not born with that ability. In order to educate or miseducate somebody into torturing or abusing somebody else, you need to manufacture some kind of consent to do it. And language is a very big part of it. So you instill fear by saying fearful words, instill hatred with hateful words. And then you start calling things in ways that conceal rather than reveal what's actually going on. So you speak of detainees instead of prisoners of war. Prisoners of war brings about the Geneva Convention. Detainee brings about, a traffic inconvenience. You speak of enhanced interrogation. Interrogation is what you do to a suspect. You enhance it. Well, this is an important crime. You don't call it torture. Face people that are so desperate that want to kill themselves and commit suicide in prison, as many Guantanamo prisoners have tried and done, you don't call that suicide. That sheds a bad light on the prison. You call it a self-harm gesture. I'm kidding you not. Suicide is supposed to be called in Guantanamo. Hunger strikes are called total voluntary fastings. These are religious fanatics, of course, so you would expect them to do religious things. And it's voluntary, sure. Nobody's forcing them to hunger strike, and so on. There's lots of these examples in my article in your book that readers can benefit from, I think.
Almeredo Ojeda, this is Mickey Huff. Just wanted to interject again. You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Mm-hmm. I'm here with Andy Lee Roth this morning. And you start out your piece here with a great quote from Noam Chomsky that says, "For those who stubbornly seek freedom around the world, there can be no more urgent task than to come to understand the mechanisms and practices of indoctrination. Propaganda is to democracy what violence is to totalitarianism."
Absolutely, absolutely. The dirty little secret is that we want to control people. And if we can't control them by violence or force, we have to control them by words and convince them they need to be controlled. And that's where propaganda comes in. It's a very perceptive view of Chomsky.
Dr. Ojeda, another term that you've helped to bring to wider public attention is the term dryboarding.
Uh-huh.
Indeed, you brought forward one of the top 25 stories this year that evidence points to the use of dry boarding at Guantanamo. Could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yes.
And what do we mean by dry boarding, and what is the evidence? How did you reach the conclusion that dry boarding might be going on at Guantanamo?
Well, dry boarding is a practice of enhanced interrogation, as it goes, as torture goes, called. And what it involves is stuffing the mouth of the victim with cloth, usually socks, nylon socks. And this induces suffocation. Not the misperception of suffocation, it's actual suffocation. The only thing is that it is controlled so that it can last longer and not produce the natural outcome of suffocation, which is death. This happened apparently this happened for a fact in a prison in South Carolina with Ali Saleh Al-Mari, who was a Qatari citizen that came to the U.S. to study, was deemed an enemy combatant and was interrogated very severely, very brutally. And one of the methods they used to interrogate him was this. Dry boarding, this stuffing of cloth into his mouth. The reason that came to me was that I was doing the Guantanamo Testimonials Project, as you mentioned, and I get a news alert about stories related to Guantanamo, and I heard about this story in connection to other unrelated things to Guantanamo, but it immediately set off an alarm in my head about one of the questions I had when I did the research on the first three deaths in Guantanamo. They were alleged suicide, they were alleged hangings, but there were a number of unanswered questions, one of which was, why did they have cloth stuffed in their mouths? The people who killed themselves in Guantanamo did, in addition to having some mask-like contraptions over their mouths. And the Almeri story, the dry-boarding story, answered those questions, at least as a possibility that needs to be investigated, and that is that the masks were used to hold the cloth in the mouth so that they wouldn't be able to spit it out. Well, the readers can take a look at the details there, but that's pretty much how I got to it.
Almirando Ojeda, we need to move on right now, but we so appreciate your work and your contributions to Project Censored. Could you say quickly how our audience can find the Guantanamo's testimonial project at UC Davis?
It's humanrights.ucdavis.edu.
Thanks so much, Almirando.
Thank you.
Our next guest this morning, as we take a whirlwind tour through the many, many contributors to Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution, now out from Seven Stories Press, is Tara Drabji. Tara Drabji has been a producer and host on KPFA, focused on South Asia, nuclear weapons, and environmental justice. She also had produced a program, Kashmir Speaks, does monthly segments on Kashmir, archived at Drabji.com, Drabji.com. She's also the author of poems, short stories, and articles, and is finishing her first novel. Tara, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mickey.
Tara, you contributed a chapter this year that we thought was really important, called An Occupation of Truth, Indian-Administered Kashmir. And this kind of came on the heels of some of the stories of censorship there. And you basically picked it up and you visited there. Could you tell us, listeners, briefly here about your research, what you found, and how it connects to what we're doing here at Project Censored?
Absolutely. You know, growing up, I often heard about the Kashmir subject, and it was very taboo, and it was largely framed as a dispute between India and Pakistan. But as I researched it more and found out more, I found that there's a huge, vibrant, populist freedom independence movement there. And so I was really interested in learning more about that and finding out more. So I actually went into Kashmir, and right as I was about to go into Kashmir, one of our colleague reporters from Alternate was not allowed to enter India because of his coverage of Kashmir. And so there was a huge amount of fear and concern about me going in right then. And at that point, I had not covered Kashmir, so I was able to go in and cover. And, you know, what was breaking then was really a story about mass graves and thousands of buried bodies that were verified by the state at that time. And up until then, the Indian government had basically said that they were foreign militants, but the state report at this time showed they were actually the large majority of which they did DNA tests on were actually Kashmiri civilians. And so at the time that I was in Kashmir, this was breaking, and I was able to go in and just talk with people about their experience. There have been over 8,000 documented disappearances of people, and so this is just people going to work, and they're gone. They never come home, and the families have this sense where they're in a state of purgatory, that hope that one day there'll be that knock on the door and they'll come back, set against the finding of these mass graves, bones and bones heaped all over districts in Kashmir. And so, you know, when I got in there and started looking at what are the stories that the Indian government does not want to come out, in terms of the Indian administered portion of Kashmir, this was definitely one. And following on the heels of your last speaker, I think the other thing is definitely torture. There have been over 60,000 cases of documented torture in Kashmir, including heinous acts, everything from injecting petrol into anuses, rape, psychological torture, and waterboarding. And, you know, today there's a huge nonviolence resistance. I mean, I think that was one of the things that struck me. It's Kashmir is the most densely militarized land on earth. The paramilitary and military, you know, the soldier to civilian ratio is something like 1 to 12. So it's enormous in terms of the presence, and now the people are really in a stage of nonviolent uprising. They'll shut down the city in strikes for days, go through curfews, and so it's really phenomenal in terms of looking at how, you know, just being able to support in solidarity a people's movement working for their own independence and through largely nonviolent means today.
Tara Drabji, again, thanks so much for dropping in with us this morning. We're trying to cover a lot of the different contexts here, and I know in your chapter you have, again, some very important segments on the politics of mapping and paths to freedom and so on, and we would certainly like to have you back on for an extended segment. This morning we're just trying to sort of whet people's appetite for what all's in the book and how many important underreported stories there are.
Absolutely, and people can definitely check out my website, drabji.com, for links around Kashmir and other issues, and we'll get this segment up there, too. Thanks so much for having me, Mickey.
Thanks, Tara Drabji. After a brief musical break from the California Honey Drops, we'll be joined by Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine and end things out on some positive notes. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on the Morning Mix. I'm Mickey Huff in studio today with Andy Lee Roth. We're wrapping up our segment on Censored 2013, Dispatches from the Media Revolution. And there are so many more things here that we're not able to cover in the hour, including our wonderful cartoon contributions from Khalil Bendib, a foreword by Dr. Nafees Ahmed, and so many others. But we're going to end our show today looking at some things that we do at Project Censored as well, which we look at signs of hope, patterns of emerging change and development. Ken Burrows, who couldn't be with us this morning, has contributed to that for a number of years. But also, another person that's really contributed to Project Censored over the years is Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine, the co-founder and executive editor there, and also editor of a recent book, This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99%. And this year, in our chapter on media democracy in action, where we showcase many, many wonderful people that are doing important independent journalism, we're honored to have Sarah Van Gelder with us and her contribution this year on the 12 most hopeful trends to build on. Sarah, you're joining us.
Yes, I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, thanks so much. We only have about 3 or 4 minutes left, I'm afraid, but just tell us a little bit about this contribution and more about what you're doing at Yes Magazine.
Well, we're really interested in where there are opportunities for big change, where there are breakthrough moments. And you mentioned the 99% movement, this piece that I wrote at the beginning of the year, the 12 most hopeful trends to build on, really focuses in on the fact that our economic system is so dysfunctional and there are all sorts of alternatives coming along that people are starting to build on. In particular, the cooperatives movement is one I'm especially excited about. Our spring issue is going to be on that. We're doing the research for it right now. And there is such an outpouring of interest in economic alternatives that can get us away from the Wall Street system. So that's something that I'm very excited about and that I think is really blossoming, both in the United States and around the world.
And indeed that International Year of Cooperatives is our number 7 story in the 2013 list. Jessica Reeder, who writes and reports for Yes Magazine, helped to bring that story forward. And nearly 1 billion people worldwide are co-op member owners, according to the UN, and the co-op is expected to be the world's fastest growing business model by 2025. So why, when we have such a widespread and indeed positive development like that, why don't we see coverage of that in the corporate media? Why is it up to independent reporters and Project Censored to bring that kind of story forward to a wider audience, Sarah?
Well, obviously the cooperatives don't have the money that they're spending on advertising that the big corporations and Wall Street has. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting is in the United States, our co-op movement has been around for quite some time, but people have gotten a little complacent about what we actually have when we have all those credit unions and we have all those farmers co-ops. And we've actually, in some way, they've become a little bit depoliticized instead of really thinking about, you know, this is an exciting alternative. This is something that really works for our members. I think the movement has gotten a little complacent, and I think it's just now starting to pick itself up again. A really good example of that is last year, you may remember the Move Your Money moment when so many people took their money out of Bank of America and Chase Bank and put it into their local banks and credit unions. And now there's this real opportunity for these credit unions to say, okay, we've got this infusion of support. You know, what are we going to do with that? How are we going to become a real part of rebuilding a much more collaborative, cooperative 99% economy?
And Sarah Van Gelder, we only have a few seconds left here, about 30 seconds, but you have another segment. You have another piece here on cleaning up elections and a focus on cleaning up elections, and that's a very timely story.
Yeah, I don't know how much you can say about that in a few seconds, but obviously the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court was a huge setback, and we at Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org have been tracking where is the best work happening to overturn Citizens United, to put in a constitutional amendment, to reclaim the right of we the people to choose our government, not having corporations choose the government.
Well, Sarah Van Gelder, thanks so much for joining us this morning. As again, we really just wanted to have a whirlwind overview of the many, many wonderful independent journalists and organizations that are really working to make the world a better place, a much more informed place where we can act meaningfully and move forward collectively with the 99%. And you're a big part of that and the folks at Yes Magazine. And thanks so much for your work and contributions.
Thank you so much, Mickey. And there's lots more of these stories at YesMagazine.org.
That about wraps it up for today. I've been joined by Dr. Andy Lee Roth. My co-host, Peter Phillips, will be with us next week. We'd like to thank Rod Akil at the controls. I'd like to thank Anthony Fest, who's been doing all kinds of busy calling back there for us. We'd also like to announce that Project Censored will have our book release tomorrow, party at Moe's Books on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, California. It'll be streaming live at noliesradio.org. That's Saturday, November 3rd, 7:30 p.m. That's free, so we hope to see you there and learn more about many of the things we talked about today. There's also one more announcement I have. That would be Monday, November 12th at the Grand Lake Theater is the Wall Street Conspiracy film. It begins at 7:30. This is a benefit for KPFA and Project Censored, so please try to make it out. Grand Lake Theater, November 12th, Wall Street Conspiracy, one-time showing, and the producer of the film will be there. That's at 7:30 with Peter Phillips. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us. This is Mickey Huff, Project Censored Show, 94.1 FM KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Up next, Democracy Now!